On today's episode of Project Pundits Unplugged, Jim gets frustrated earlier than usual.
So here's my problem. If you go back to, oh my God, I don't want to get wound up on this stupid topic. At least it's not inflation, but like.
I have got him spiced up within, we're in the, just the pre-work here. Not even 15 minutes and I've got him hyped up already. This is going to be a great episode, folks. I'm letting you know.
Braden doesn't get the feedback he was looking for.
Did you get?
I got it. I mean, it was all right. Of course. Yeah.
It was all right. It was so apropos.
It was about 60% apropos. But I saw the matching. I got it.
Braden works on his oratory skills.
This thing where you eat fast like you have good... you sound like a moron.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the next episode of the Project Pundits Unplugged pod. It's been a little bit. We've been busy during this last stretch. It's been a school ending, graduations, and some other things among some professional stuff. So we're trying to get back to a standard time on this, but, you know, we're doing our best here. So in this episode... cover a couple of current events. Braden, I don't think, is aware of some of them. And then I thought just...
That was a teaser.
Yeah, just because of... I saw something that probably on one level is inappropriate, laughing hysterically at it. But there's apparently a South Park episode. I didn't watch the whole episode. I just saw a clip that was talking about... navigating the American healthcare system, and so we'll
that's cool.
And the topic of the episode, or that episode of South Park, was called the end of obesity. And so they get into the Ozempic and take it to absurd levels and everything. But anyways, the navigating, they made a song out of navigating.
Wait, hang on. So I was gonna say, I mean, to be clear, I think both you and I know from your story, certainly from mine, I'm a college graduate, you know, a person who works in the healthcare field. And even for me, it is challenging to navigate the healthcare system effectively. I know for you, too. I mean, you have a different approach to it. You're paying money to have someone navigate it for you, but it's still challenging.
Yeah, and there's so many comments. So we'll why do I want to talk about healthcare? I guess simply because, to Braden's point, it's super complex, and there's a handful of things. And I put it in some notes, but like there's some common misconceptions about how healthcare actually works in a country, like what role the insurers play, what role employers pay, how this works, and it's just interesting to cover some of that. And you know, look, don't get me wrong. There's plenty of blame to go around about why the system operates like it does and whatnot. But understanding kind of the big moving parts and like who owns decision making, I think that's an interesting one. Most people don't understand who owns decision making in that entire process. So I figured we'd cover that a little bit because this is a life Braden and I have lived for 20 plus years in the bowels of the insurance side of it, which kind of gives you a broader picture of how it all fits together. So I figured we'd chat about that. And then, you know, I think you could do 10 episodes on this as well, but it's topical. And with a lot of the changes in drug approvals, it just is a lot we can talk about. So it was a topical thing. So I figured we'd cover that. But there was one of my friends had brought up this story about Canada. So I wanted to bring this up with Braden, and
Jim has teased me about this twice. I'm dying now to hear
I don't know
what the story is.
I don't think this law is passed yet, but it was proposed, I think, in February. Canada has gotten, and Justin Trudeau has gotten pretty down the liberal side of like, you know, you can't say things. You got to be careful with pronouns. Like, he's very much in support. I think well-intended trying to make it a safe environment for everybody, right, and all of that. So they proposed this bill called the Online Harms Act. It's Bill C-63. I know this because I wrote it down. And they have a provision in there. And again, it's summarized. I read it, and it's true that's there. They actually have a provision that would allow you to be convicted. You would commit a future crime and place you under house arrest. They call it the pre-crime clause, which made me laugh about Minority Report because
you're making this.
I'm not. So
when you're convicted of that, does a big marble like drop down and go like
give a name and right
ting and it says Jim Quest slander or whatever like no
but maybe that's in there but so Braden, if you're on just look up Canadian pre-crime. There's I have the actual bill. We'll post links to it. And a lot of this is around protection and a real additional hard crackdown on child pornography.
In the first thing that I'm looking at, it says a troubling bill brings to mind the dystopian world. In the film Minority Report, like they're referencing Minority Report as part of this.
Yep.
So what were you saying? Sorry, I'm just trying to read the details here.
Well, I mean, the intention again is about hate speech, hate online, a lot about really pushing to punish hard conveyors of child pornography and all that, which I'm a big fan of, right? And actually, another controversial part, it puts service providers on the hook. If they find or are aware of it, if things on their platform, they don't report it. There's really harsh penalties for everybody along the chain. And in there, there's a whole bunch of other stuff. And I'm, the actual bill is here, but I found it interesting that they would have something in there related. And then they got on TV and I forget which of the equivalent of secretaries in Canada was on there, but they were defending this clause. Being like, why wouldn't you? It just cracks me up that in this day and age, that concept would be there.
Wow. So gone is the days of innocent until proven guilty. I mean, I guess maybe that's just an American concept.
And, I think we get this typical exaggeration of like what's in there, like, oh, this is... We're not going to be able to talk. Free speech is out the window. Yeah, we got to be careful about any sort of erosion on free speech. I'm there, and really, there's a lot of debate on free speech and misinformation on this. But we should always be challenging that. But free speech is, such a key tenet of why things work
in the United States, not
around the world. No.
I mean, oh my goodness, there are plenty of countries that. Free speech is not remotely a right that you have. It's very American, I would say. This is an interesting bill. It scares me a little bit. I will say it's one of the first bills. So you have authoritarian countries where they might even have laws that protect your ability to report, to speak, whatever. But in reality, if I let's say I'm a reporter that very openly speaks out against Putin and I'm in Russia, I'm not going to last very long. I know this, right? Whether or not there's a law or not, as opposed to in the United States, we really take that for granted. And in some cases, people don't realize that there actually are limitations on free speech. I tried to tell someone this the other day. I forget who it was. It wasn't you. We were talking. I'm trying to remember. I don't remember the context. But I was explaining to someone, I'm like, free speech isn't an absolute right. I mean, there are limitations. They're like, nope, it's in the Bill of Rights.
No, it's not.
It is in the Bill of Rights.
But there are stated certain things. Right, yeah.
And so they're like, give me an example. And I'm like, well, the classic example that we use in law is yelling fire in a theater that would cause harm to people in a stampede or something because you would cause panic and you would cause harm to people through your speech. And there are other types of speech, slander and other certain things that do you remember way back when One of the shock jocks. It wasn't
Stern.
What's his name? Howard no, it wasn't Stern. Stern. It was someone else. There was some one of the other guys. You'll probably remember. He said he made some comment that was very racist in nature. I can't remember what it was.
Was it Don Imus?
Imus sounds familiar. I can't remember.
I think it might be.
Wasn't someone who I listened to, but whatever it was, he said this, and fairly quickly. His sponsors and other people were backing out, right? And the radio station said, yeah, we're pulling your show. And there was this huge backlash where people said that's a violation of his free speech rights. And I banged my head, Jim, like for a week listening to morons come over and over on the radio. And what I wanted to say, right, I guess I now have kind of a pulpit to say it from, is to say free speech means... We don't pre-censor you from saying the thing.
Yeah, right? You're not going to go to jail for it. Necessarily.
You're right. Sometimes you can go to jail.
You can,
but
depending on what
it is. I'm not going to stop you from saying it.
That's
but
right.
What it doesn't do is it doesn't say there aren't consequences right. for saying the thing that you do. I fully defend his right to say really stupid, stupid things. I also fully defend the rights of his sponsors to say, don't want my products to have anything to do with him, and a radio station to make, and this is the key, not a free speech thing, a business decision, right? To say, Imus, I don't care at all. Imus sounds familiar to me. I don't care at all, you know, from the content of me personally, I would say, get the guy off the air, what a moron. But separately, hey, I don't care if what you're saying out there is this or that or the other thing, but what I do care about is that if our sponsors are pulling and you're no longer an economic viability, I'm not a charity, and I'm not here to put you on the air to lose money for us. Goodbye. Goodbye not because I'm censoring you. It's goodbye because you're not an economic asset to the radio station anymore. See you later. And somehow everyone missed this is nothing about free speech and everything about the consequences of what you just said. And it's like somehow they want to say, no, I get to say anything and I can't be held accountable for anything that I say, which is just flat out not true. That's not what free speech is.
It's so fascinating. So there's a lot.
You won't go to jail. You won't
there's a lot. There's a lot in the current culture about two things, right? So one is Elon Musk. Genius on like the ability of what he can get done, thoughts, like so much amazing stuff, and then he just does childish things. So anyways, he buys Twitter. It's like
you're right, right?
Like,
yeah, and
it's like a toy. I think to
all
him.
Of us,
it was a toy
all of
him.
Us saw what we probably many of us perceived as child or immature yeah. behavior in some ways. Sure, absolutely.
And you know, his whole thing is like, I believe in, you know, free speech, and I think again it gets mixed up. Twitter isn't owned by the government. It's, again, a private business. So if Twitter wants to ban Donald Trump, they can ban Donald Trump. Now, it's a really interesting argument, Braden. I don't know if there's any case history to where that is considered a public square. Like, if you say Twitter is a public square,
a little bit.
I don't,
it gets tricky.
Like, it gets tricky. Well, I mean, so if it's a public square, then you're in different territory.
So Jim, you bring up a good point. If it's just purely a private place, then of course you'd be like, hey, I ban them completely. The internet is quirky. And one of the reasons is, so the closest comparison that you have is, and this is oftentimes in legal circles, they have to look at what's the closest thing that we have to compare this with. And I think initially a lot of the internet was compared to private cable stations. And they looked and they said, it's a semi-private, semi-public entity where you control, an audience that can see things. They have to kind of direct themselves. And in this case, it's more public than private because in the case of cable, usually they were also paying a fee on top of it. But it was this quasi semi-public, semi-private. And in those cases... The government did rule that it's a public forum and that you would have to treat it similar to the way that you did with broadcast stations and other places.
To a point, and they backed off of that through court cases and everything. So you can get what can be censored, right? Similar to free speech, like there's this concept of censorship, like in cable versus public broadcast things. The argument was swearing. So an easy one was swearing. They eventually allowed that on the private cable, but not on the public. And that's still generally how it works today. You can get fined by the FCC if you swear on like ABC, NBC, CBS, public broadcasting. But if you're on HBO, like you can, and then you get into pornography censorship standards.
And I think the arguments that they made on those were about control. A TV that's just open to the airwaves, a child, you know, can probably more easily access content without their parents' control or permission versus somewhere that has a
And there's a lot of case law on this. Something. They actually started to divide the day into when kids would watch TV, and then it was all right. We allow swearing and views of naked buttockses, but only after 9 p.m. And it's true. And I don't know if you remember this, but do you remember the NYPD Blue, when that was the famous thing when they showed what's that detective, the short guy detective with the mustache? They showed his butt. It was Dennis Franz.
The butt thing.
Detective, and it was a big deal at the time about what's allowed and what's not allowed.
It better have been after 9 o'clock, Jim, is all I can say.
Now you have the other thing where it's like there's a whole thing. So how some of the Canadian stuff and. This is, again, why people like to... Justin Trudeau, in my opinion, has made interesting choices, like fighting the truck drivers on the whole thing and a lot of the stuff. And then the other one that was interesting is compelled speech. Like, so you have to respect pronouns and actually use certain pronouns. So that whole thing has been in a thing, and Canada has been, you know, I don't know if any of that, like Jordan Peterson was involved with that, and others are like, you're never going to compel me to use certain blah, 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 that... Again, compelled speech is another interesting topic.
Compelled speech has been around, or the concept around, has been around for a long time. I mean, our current iteration of it for pronouns and whatever else, right, is just another version of, can you ever force people to have a like mind as to how to think about, describe, and you're never, ever going to get consensus on, even amongst people who want and have these things, there's not consensus what you should use and what offends this person. With a million opinions, there's a million ways to offend people. And, you know, I think it's madness, personal opinion, rather than just say, hey, let's just all take a reasonable and, you know, people call me by the wrong name, right? In a really simple example, they call me by the wrong name for most of my life, right? Braden was not a common name. It was always Brandon. I've been called Brandon most of my life.
I'm annoyed. Most of my life. I'm annoyed when people refer to you as Brandon. I get mad at them.
it's my whole life.
It's not intentional.
It never is, right? And this is why, like, why would you waste emotional energy? I've got a limited amount of it. I don't need to spend my life trying to find ways to get offended, because there's plenty of them out there. What people call me really just should not, I mean, my God.
I mean, I've been called a lot of things.
Well, and you, I mean, you yourself, right? You had a name that probably wasn't, kids were kind with, right? Mean. And
no, and I think they should all have been, and frankly, I mean, even now going on, let's see, when how old are you in sixth grade? Like 12?
Yeah, like about 12.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still under the belief that those kids you picked on me should be executed. You know, like
kids can be terrible.
It doesn't matter. They grew up. Now they're adults, and
they still deserve the punishment.
I don't remember getting any written apologies from these little heifers. So.
And there's not like a statute of limitations on any of this stuff. Right?
I'll move to Canada. There's probably a law in Canada now. You know, child on child abuse.
Canada versus
yep.
Billy.
But I changed
Billy
my
Johnson.
Last name. You're right. I mean, I'm like, I didn't care for me. It made me who I am. And, you know, yes, it created probably some autoimmune diseases that I'm still dealing with. And while my body was getting wired up, and it, you know, created certain mental cycles, but it's also created some positive drive, right? So adversity can go either way. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see when I'm dead and what I've accomplished and how young I die. And, you know,
a lot of my sense of humor, I think, too, comes from being picked on as a kid.
Oh, he had red hair, too. So that's like, I never got the red hair thing. Like, I never understood why that was a thing, but I get it. But it was to a lot of people. Like,
they weren't too bad about my hair. Just, you know, I was a little nerd, is what it was. And so being a nerd, you were the subject of those who were not nerds and didn't understand a nerd's world. Today, man, I wear it like a badge of honor. It's kind of cool to be a nerd today, believe it or not.
It very much is.
Which I'm jealous of. It wasn't when we were kids.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot to say. There's you know, what's considered hate speech. That's, again, I think it's similar to yelling fire in a theater, right? If hate speech leads to, it has to lead to harm or into, I don't know. And then what's interesting, another form of expression that people like is how do you fly a flag, right? So there's another form of compelled speech. People wanted you to fly the flag only a certain way. I mean, we have a Supreme Court justice who's flying the flag upside down at his house. So Alito, that whole thing. But yeah, I mean, that's another form. Like if you're like, there's that whole thing with the burning of the flag that we went through. That was probably right at the time when you're in law school, or at least it was probably a topic that came up. Like burning of the flag is like, you know,
it was pretty well before I was in law school.
Oh, maybe that was in the 80s.
I'm old, but not quite that old. But I mean, sure, free speech, that's been a kind of a,
well, it came back up in the late 80s, early 90s.
Free speech.
Yeah, I know it was the 60s when originally a lot of like people were burning flags, Vietnam War and all that. And I'm sure it happened going even further back, but
Ron Say, for some reason, that one sticks in my head. Right? I don't know. Well, you wouldn't have been a Dodgers fan, but there was a Dodger game where the first baseman, his name was
Rick Monday,
way back when, someone was doing a typical, at the time it was, in fashion for everyone to burn the flag, you know, to make a statement, and someone lit one up and, you know, had dropped it on the field and was running away from security. And the first baseman actually ran out, grabbed it, and put it out as quick as he could and, like, was, like, holding it up. And the whole crowd just, like, lit up. And as a kid, that left an impression on me, right? I mean, here I'm this impressionable kid, and I watched someone, like, defending this flag, which to me was a symbol of a country that I certainly loved and was taught to love. And so I'm like,
Rick Monday,
he's the greatest guy ever.
Yeah, and then, you know, you get the whole Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the anthem, which I just, again, people who don't understand this country and especially understand what he was doing and what he was protest, like, you guys are just like, again, this is a thing I just, hyper-nationalism is one of the most destructive forces, and aside from religion, which I think is the most destructive force in the history of the world, right? Closely behind that is nationalism. You know, taking any of that too far, it just reinforces tribal instincts and causes people to kill each other. It's just insane.
Great job of avoiding both religion and politics today. This is fantastic. Move us on, Jim.
So Minority Report. So yeah. So pre-crime in Canada, you get an ankle bracelet.
And you get the police coming and slamming you before you've ever committed the crime.
That's right. So really quick on healthcare, I think similar to how we covered consulting in the last episode, just I thought so. Well, so Brayden, can you watch a clip on South Park, like with the audio, or would you have to?
Let me try. Do you want me to watch it right now?
Yeah, let's watch.
Okay,
it.
Hang on.
This is when we're gonna show you guys this video. So.
Wow, look at this place.
Well, hello there. Looking to get some insurance?
It can't get worse. I love the
oh, great. You're here to pay your
okay,
no,
wait.
No,
not all insurance people look like the guy who's like, "Hello." but many of them do. I'm just going to say.
We want to file a claim to get my friend's
weight. I'm watching him type.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. This reminds me of the sloth episode from Zootopia where they have the sloths at DMV at the DMV. Yep. Have you seen that?
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Number or anything?
Let me just speak with our medical director.
Phone.
Oh, hang on. He's dialing a rotary phone.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, we don't pay for medicines for obesity because it's not a disease.
Oh, this is Ozempic, isn't it?
That was the medical director. The medical director decides what claims are valid for us to pay for.
But you didn't say who the patient was or what was wrong with him.
Right. The medical director's job is just to say no.
Look, my friend's mom has been paying you people for years, and his doctor says his weight is a medical concern and obesity is a disease. Oprah Winfrey said so.
Okay.
Oprah Winfrey said so.
Down. I didn't realize I was dealing with someone who had so much determination. If you do a little more work, I think we can get your medications paid for.
What? We can?
Yeah, you see, the doctors and the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies all kind of work together. So all you have to do is navigate the American healthcare
system. All you have to do is navigate the American healthcare system. Oh, there's a song.
Yes.
It's there for you. Just fill out these forms.
We're gonna get better and we're gonna be strong and as healthy as can be.
I need to send you to imaging.
Quest.
Just
ooh, I need to get an appointment with Quest. That reminds me. Dang it. All right, yeah, I'll have to put it.
I can't sign this for insurance. His original doctor needs to sign this.
We go back to the doctor to get that thing for insurance. Then go back to insurance.
A dot matrix printer.
We're navigating the American healthcare system.
Filled out and then faxed to your insurance company.
We're filling out forms and we're scanning those forms and then we're emailing those forms to get them back to insurance.
We need confirmation from a different specialist.
Let's go and navigate the American healthcare system. It's the best system
of them all. No, we already talked to the insurance
company. Oh my heavens.
They were supposed to talk to you.
It's the best system of them all.
Go back to the specialist who talks to the insurance company. The facts is the medical advisor on the phone in the Maui. And we're going in one place and we're coming out the other place. And we're back over here now and I was just over there. And I'm getting confused and it's getting dark. And my mind's all different colors. And I think I'm lost. Hey, Barry, I'm going to get you.
Okay, ending that with Interstellar is so per. We need. I think we need that whole clip in there, or like most of it, because that's hilarious.
Well, you know, I think this is the point, right? And you know, it'd be one thing. So let's pivot to the healthcare. So it'd be one thing, and I'm gonna put this. I should have grabbed the stats ahead of time, right? So I was telling Braden at my youngest son graduation, the keynote speaker, or the commencement speaker, was Bernie Sanders. And his commencement speech tied to, because Colby's school, it's University of New England, graduates a lot of nurses, pre-med, med, you know, kind of dentists, things like that. So he tied his stump speech, and anybody who knows Bernie Sanders, one of his passions is trying to get affordable health care to every person in a country. In fact, he believes it's a human right, you know, and everybody should have access and, you know, affordable access to, and he tied all that together. So he talked about a lot of this stuff, and then the South Park clip talks about some of it. And I think what used to be the case is we used to be the top in the world in life expectancy, birth rates, like mortality rates.
Mortality rates. Yeah. I knew what you meant.
We're like 38th in infant mortality, which is just horrible. Like, We do have some of the best pharmaceutical development in the world. Like, it's a really funky system, but if you just if you step back and objectively look at the data, we follow me. Our life expectancy has actually gone down. I mean, some of that's attributable to COVID, different things. But just understanding, you know, and people, like, there's so much tribal discussion about, you know, and some rightfully so, not wanting the government to take over more of, like, a functional industry, right? Like healthcare, right? Is that better? I will tell you, before we even get into it, my opinion after having worked in this for so long, I started off by saying, yeah, I don't want the government involved in any of this. And I've come out and we've talked about this in prior episodes, this concept of the least worst option. In my opinion, the least worst option with healthcare is a preventative and baseline coverage, including prescription, preventative, you know, normal, like, coverage for everybody in a country. So you don't have to worry about it and everything else. Yes, taxes, however, go and have it be. You take probably Medicare as the basis for it, and single system for all, and then have a robust secondary market to where people can buy, you know, enhanced policies and whatnot. I think we're the only major developed country to not offer 100% coverage baseline for their populations, and there's lots of different models out there, you know, and it's hard to compare apples to apples because culturally and size-wise, some of these countries that have full coverage are the size of, like, you know, Virginia. Like, we're a huge country, right? And we have states and, you know, different things. But
can I just interject one thought on that, Jim? I hear what you're saying. I think culturally, now this is a very different context. But culturally, I wonder whether or not our country is ready for that. And the reason I say that is knowing on the delivery side. So I have people who I know intimately who are on the delivery side of things, doctor friends. I have several of them, including family members, etc. And there is a huge cultural difference in the use of the medical system in the United States versus in a lot of these places that you're talking about. And culturally, sure. So a couple of things. Number one, we have vastly different concepts of end-of-life care than many other countries. I'll say mainly Western Europe. I don't know about a lot of Eastern countries. But we are obsessed with staying alive. If I have to spend, by any means necessary, so if I have to spend $1 million to live that extra 10 minutes, I'll do it, right?
I found it's the family around them.
Jim, you're absolutely right. And so we'll just say, all I'll say is, yep, there are very different attitudes culturally towards that, where in many other places they'll be like, oh no, we just want to be together and, you know, hospice care and make them comfortable. And to be fair, there are plenty of people in the United States who do that too. We are by far heavier consumers per capita of healthcare generally than any other country in the world, period. Like, by orders of magnitude, the way that we consume is different. There'd have to be a sea change in the way, both the way that we're consuming as well as our attitudes towards consuming healthcare, before we'd be able to support a change like that.
I think what we want to get into is a little bit of structural thing. I actually disagree with you. All the things you stated are true. My experience with healthcare, well, and Braden has a lot of similar experience.
Neither of us are particularly healthy, is it?
We have a particular interest in how we engage with the healthcare system. That's a whole thing, and you're your opinions are always biased by your personal experience. But no, working sure. in there, the one yeah. thing I will say, and I've spent, again, the last 20 plus years in the healthcare industry on the side of healthcare insurers. And the one thing you learn is that we have there's no words that can explain how inefficient the system is that we built in this country. And it wasn't purposely built like this. It just evolved to this thing. So Brandon, where I disagree with you is not so much what you say. So we have cultural things and other drivers that are going to always keep utilization higher. And there probably does need to be some cultural shifts. And it's going to be really interesting too, because if the more we extend life and longevity, that's increased the burden, and we have a mm-hmm. declining amount of people going into the medical field and nurses. So there's other challenges. But the thing I think I want to cover in this episode, and you may disagree with me on this, is like how the system operates in order to give care to people and then pay for that care is full of so much administrative waste, inefficiencies and everything else. And here's my premise. And if you had to look at that problem and you had to solve it one time, you can get some, pull an Elon Musk or someone. If you had to solve that one time, right? And you say, all right, here's the system. Here's the drivers. Here's how it needs to operate. Here's what the issues are. You could solve that reasonably, in my opinion. But that is not how we're operated. We do have centralized organizations like the CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Medicaid and Medicare Services, and whatnot. However, the majority of people still get their insurance from commercial plans, and we have private insurance companies, and we have all sorts of variations on that. And here's the thing. We have to solve the problem. That problem I talked about how do you set up a geographic area to give people health insurance, to allow them to see their doctors, to get care and everything else, is solved. It has to be solved thousands of times. Everywhere where there's a different insurance company in a different region, in a different state, and even a different locality, you're solving that problem within the context of that space. So instead of solving it once globally, like for a baseline service, you're solving it thousands of times, and that's impossible. Because I will promise you, and I'm not getting even. Brayden, I've worked with a lot of people. The number of people who actually fundamentally understand how the whole thing works and can abstractly think about how to fix the system, I can count them on one, maybe two hands. And so my premise with you, Brayden, is that I'd rather just solve it once for the baseline preventative care, baseline coverage and everything else, get the incentive models right and everything. And then you can't just displace a gazillion workers who work in healthcare either. So you can't just go governmental and like you're going to have to lay off. You can't disrupt that kind of an industry. So that was my whole thing. Solve it once. People can get their prescription drugs without worrying about it and everything else and whatnot. Catastrophic care is covered by the government. Theoretically, you should be able to remove a ton of the administrative overhead by solving it that way and then having an incentive model for a secondary insurance market. So that's my thought on
single payer, saying. Right? I mean, a kind
single
of a
payer
standard
for a baseline.
Single payer model is your proposal. I mean, administratively, right?
Yeah.
It certainly does solve lots of things. It also creates the attendant challenges that you would expect in terms yep. of care rationing and other yep. things that they experience in places like HHS and the British
Health and Human Services.
The
British one. There's some rationing of care, some long waits in some cases, identifying, you're right, end of life care, elective versus required, you know, but this, my argument is, well, it's pardon my French, and you can bleep this out, but, you know, the secondary market, that would mean people who can afford secondary care to get to the front of the line would still be able to.
So you wouldn't do a Canadians, they're coming up. left and right.
A lot of Canadians.
You wouldn't do a Canadian model, which for those unfamiliar with Canada, it's actually illegal. You cannot get private insurance in Canada. You are required to use the national system and the national system only, which is circumvented by most Canadians by simply just doing medical tourism. And
sure.
I mean, you can do that anywhere, right? Yep. Why come to the United States? Just keep going south, and you could do it in Mexico.
Oh, for some surgery, it's not cost effective, right? And the outcomes are equal or better in some cases. And certain countries have now specialized certain services to where they've gotten some of the best people, and they'll pay for you private flight, room, like whole thing.
And so. And you still probably get like prime care, fantastic. Yep. Care
and usually U.S. trained doctors. That's the funny thing. Uh-huh. They're U.S. trained doctors and sure. whatnot. So that's the general premise. And so really quick, Brian, I think you and I can do this quick-ish, pretty quick. But just fundamentally, I think what people don't understand is I think there's a group of entities that play a role. We talked about the government. We talked about insurers. So the big ones are Blue Cross Blue Shield, all the different variations of that. Cigna, United, you know, it's not Anthem anymore. It's whatever they're called now. But, you know, and then you have regional plans. I'm in an area where, you know, there's Harvard Pilgrim and Tufts Health Plan. And you're in California. You have like there's community based plans. Like there's eight of them. You know, there's Community Health Plan of California. There's, you know, there's lots Cross, of different
there's
ones.
There's Kaiser. There's a whole bunch. Yeah.
Yep. And then there's, you know, the providers or anybody who provides some sort of a service, right? So your primary care physician, a hospital, a specialist, like a neurology specialist, and then you get it's all a variation of the same. Even in like behavioral health, you'll have therapists, psychologists, you have dentist, it's another form, just another flavor of it.
Quasi
you have
form.
Providers.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, there's dentists and chiropractors are quasi doctors. I get it.
Whatever you want to call them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they get some sort of license, right, to practice. I don't know. But
well, and you terrible. Also
we're going to get a lot of dental hate.
We'll get some flames. The other tricky part too, though, is you also have oral surgeons and people who cross over between.
That's right.
And to be fair, yeah. right, most dentists, I think they all have to go through similar, if not
they do.
Almost
yep.
the same
full medical
training
degree,
as doctors,
yep.
right? Yep. Yeah. So it's they're doctors.
And then you have ancillary services, which are critically important, especially more and more, right? So your typical pharmacy, right? So, boy, we prescribe a lot. So pharmacy benefits, and then you know drug manufacturers, pharmacy benefit managers, and then all that. That's important. Then you have things like lab testing, blood tests, and all that. You have radiology for scans. So all of those things are some form of a provider. They're doing something in your healthcare. They're providing some sort of a service to your health. The insurers,
side note, by the way, Jim, yeah. radiology yeah. has gotten so much less expensive than it used to be.
Oh my God! Right?
I went. So I just had to do not terribly long ago.
Oh, we're so showing your eyeballs. That's coming
you,
up.
We should show that one. Can we show that one? Because it was awesome. But we did, I did an MRI, and the last that I had recalled, because MRIs, because it's an expensive test, they typically require these careful referrals, approvals, authorizations, all these things. But it used to be that test was like, I want to say it was a couple thousand dollars. It was a very expensive test. I went, by the way, this was... I'm not going to say uninsured. It was deductible. I'm, you know, adding up. But I was essentially paying for the cost myself. It was $400. That cost has come way down. And I see that only potentially going lower and lower to the point where at some point in the future, they'll probably be like, yeah, just go do an MRI. Who cares? It's not a big deal. We have them, you know, at every CVS
clinic like any
around.
Technology you would expect, I think, to get more and more
over
efficient,
time.
More higher resolution and all that. And then the other part, which I if I'm not careful, I can make every episode about AI because it's so exciting. But
Jim.
The other expense part of these things is then, and Braden and I, I will tell you, after Braden's scans, he sent me some, and then we spent like 2 hours looking at the scans and then trying, because Braden's wife like said you had to get the scan because he's going crazy and whatnot. So that's why Braden went. So we get the pictures back, and I'm looking at all these pictures like, where is the defect in Braden's head? And we looked and we were Googling it. And in the future, we'll just be able to be like, AI, you know, can you please tell me what part of Braden is defective, right?
You joke about that, but I wouldn't be surprised, honestly, with pattern recognition, yep, if in the not too distant future, it's you could there. Simply say, with the machine, right? Heck with no more producing scans, just hit the button, the machine. I mean, we're coming closer to the tricorder, right? where you just sort of do this. Do. We need a tricorder.
Yeah, we can put the tricorder sound and actually clip thing in there. Yep.
What oh my exactly God, what's wrong with your hands?
Look, who is responsible for the Klingon attack, and was it Clip Wong-Yu?
Was it just what?
What's happening in my mouth?
You got numb tongue?
Numb tongue?
I can fix that.
Beep, beep, right? But you're going to scan them and just say, oh, here's the defect, as opposed to here's images. With pattern recognition, AI, you should be able to say, here's what we're expecting, assess differences in this. Oh, yep, here's the pattern, and I can show you exactly where it is, what it is, and at least then send an initial result to a doctor who then can do and say, okay, yeah, we need to target it with a gamma knife or whatever it is the treatment is of the day.
You know,
yeah, we're coming that way.
We're coming close, and we're still, I think there's still a discomfort, and there will be for a little while, to where you ultimately, and we talked about this in a prior episode about decisions in like a car, you still, like a self-driving car, like you still want the human to make a certain decision. If a human makes a bad decision, kills somebody versus, you still want a human at the end making final determinations. But yeah, the efficiency of that is going to get there. So I don't want to go off on the AI thing, but I think what I want to state is you got these providers and the costs are, you know, efficiency on some of this is going down. The concept of insurance, and Braden, I think, you know, both you or I could talk about this, but I think there's one common misconception about insurance, and that is the word insurance, right?
Like, insurance is not insurance. It hasn't been for decades.
It's still there,
decades.
But I would say, what is it? Like maybe 15% of the coverage out there, maybe 20? They're still fully insured. It's not a lot.
No. But even the fully insured is not fully insured because it's no longer allowed to be, right? Follow me
on
this.
I don't know. So depending on how you define it. Right, so we should
talk
about that.
Here's what Jim's talking about, right? So just in a nutshell, right, if I can summarize this, insurance used to be this. Insurance used to be, I would, just like you would insure against a car crash, and it's a good analogy, right? Or your house or car crash, right? I pay money into a pool so that in the event that something happens to my car or my house, the insurance company that has this big pool of money takes some of that money, and while everyone's paying a little bit, they have a lot to work with so that when someone suffers a big loss, like the loss of their house, they can take a big pile of cash and say, oh, you paid your insurance. Here's a pile of cash to fix the problem, right? My house burns down, my car breaks. I would never expect to be able to, after my car gets in a crash and I never paid insurance, or after my house burns down, say, hey, I want to start paying insurance now so that you can go and fix my car. Doesn't work that way, right? It would not ever work, because the only people who would ever pay the money would be someone who essentially wants to say, I want to give you $10 and I want you to pay me $100,000, right? That doesn't work on anyone's financial model. Health insurance used to be exactly that model. Pay into a system, and as long as you're paying into that system beforehand, then if you have some catastrophic event, like you get into an accident or you have a heart attack or you get old and your body starts not working anymore, you've paid insurance your whole life, and you're going to use that part of that, you know, the insurance company has a big pile of cash that it's getting from everyone to be able to pay big numbers out to people who get terrible diseases or whatever it is to help them out. Insurance companies are no longer allowed to sell insurance policies. Let's be clear. From the standpoint of true insurance, right? No longer does anyone want insurance. They don't even want to insure. What people want today is to cost share. It's a completely different thing. By cost share, what I mean is, hey, let's just everyone pay into a pool small amounts of money whenever we want to, not our whole lives, not starting from the beginning, just we'll pay whenever, including maybe I won't even be insured until I get a big disease. And then I'm going to start paying a little bit, but because everyone is, then I just want you to pay my all of my healthcare expenses for $100 a month. Now think about this. The way that I think about this is, if you're an insurer, think about someone who says, I want you to cover my insurance costs for, you know, let's say that I have diabetes, obesity, you know what, I have a thousand things, a chronic condition. If I came fresh to an insurance company and you said, and I said, what's my premium going to be? It's not hard for an insurance company to do that, right? All an insurance company would do was they would say, the underwriting process would be simple. They would say, okay, how much expense do you expect to incur during the year? And the person might go through a list of their medications, their doctor visit, etc. And let's say that the total amount would be, I'll make this up, $24,000. I use $24,000 because it divides evenly into months. Great. Then as an insurance company, if you know for a certain fact that they're going to incur that much expense, their opening bid for what they would charge you as premiums would, at a minimum, if they're not making any profit, in fact, if they're operating at a huge loss, they would say, well, the minimum amount it would cost us would be $2,000 a month. And of course, the person's going to throw up their arms and say, what? There should be magic somewhere where insurance companies are just out for profit. You'd be like, well, hang on. I'm literally going to go pay doctors this year $24,000. How do you expect to pay premiums less than that? I don't understand, right? It's so people don't want insurance. They want people to cover their Medicaid, their medical expenses by pooling cost risk across a concurrent set of payers, not really insuring by creating their own pool of risk throughout a period of time. That's really the current scenario.
I mean, you took this down an interesting path. That's interesting. Was that
the wrong direction?
That's not untrue. So let's build on that example. So the one thing that was eye-opening to me when I first got into this, I'll tell you, I first got into health. So I did some work in property and casualty, which is a little bit easier to understand when it comes to insurance and all that, right? It is what Braden said for an insurance model. What was eye-opening to me that I didn't understand, and it clicked a little ways into working at Cigna, and Cigna and had a series of products. So Cigna essentially, they had some direct sales, but for the most part, they sold commercial business. Let's just talk about commercial, meaning employer groups and whatnot.
Almost exclusively ASO business.
This is what I was going to get at, right? So they had fully insured, what they called fully insured business. So I'm not sure if I agree with Braden that model's there, but it was very small and it was shrinking. When I first started there, I think it was 80%, and it quickly dropped off. And by the time I left, it was under 10%.
I think even when we started, though, it was only maybe 20% of the business. It was never a large portion.
So what's interesting about all this is, right, again, so Cigna would sell fully insured. And the problem with fully insured is, like, you had to cover all costs that came in. And again, to Braden's model, like, you can underwrite, you can assess that risk pool employer by employer, but, like, it's very hard to kind of manage those costs. So if you're going fully insured, and then this is where you get into health maintenance organizations or health management, and you had rationing and care. I don't want to get into all that, but my concept is, like, people tend to blame insurance companies, and look, but their incentive models are to, especially for the large publicly traded ones, are to, it used to be to grow their members, although membership numbers are irrelevant now. It used to be part of public reporting. That was a big thing. Now it's revenue, profitability, your typical capitalistic, you know, publicly traded company metrics. And so, Braden, you know, talk to people about that move to where, you know, people tend to blame insurance companies for making decisions and policies and everything else. And for the most part, they administer those decisions, but they, in many cases, they don't own them. Talk about what ASO means and all that.
Right. So this is the dirty little secret. It's a tricky secret that most people don't understand about insurance companies. And that is, especially for insurance companies, I'll say specifically, I know Cigna, that does very little fully insured business. It's mostly self-insured business. What that means is that when your insurance company says, sorry, we can't cover this expense, it's not part of your policy, you throw up your hands and you say, oh, stupid insurance company. And oftentimes, incorrectly, your employer will say, oh, yeah, those stupid insurance companies, right? Here's the dirty secret. It's the employer that not only owns the plan, it's the employer that has created the plan. The employer works with consultant groups to create and develop a policy and a plan that covers certain things and doesn't cover certain things based on what they can afford, right? From Cigna or any insurer's perspective, guess what? They don't get any more or less money for denying every claim or paying every claim. When it's self-insured, all they do is they're just taking your employer's money from a bank account and paying a provider. Cigna doesn't care whether or not they approve it or they reject it, because Cigna doesn't get any more or less money. They get the same amount. They process a claim. They get paid the same for rejecting the claim as for paying the claim. And the dollars don't come from Cigna. They come from your employer's bank account to the provider. So what happens is you get these sideways conversations where people say, the stupid insurer isn't approving my claim. And while that's true, it's not really the insurer that has the choice. They're bound by contract to enforce a policy that was created by the employer, your boss, your employer. And so you end up getting in these situations, like I remember one that happened while we were there at Cigna, where Cigna is enforcing a policy that they are required to enforce that was given to them by the employer. As they're enforcing this policy, it's denying a kidney transplant for a teen. It was a terribly sad situation. It was a teen who had terminal cancer. They were trying to do a kidney transplant and it wasn't on the policy because in this case, it wasn't recommended. There were a whole bunch of reasons why it just was not going to be a good idea. The employer, instead of being honest and saying, hey, this is our plan, and out of the goodness of our heart, we're going to, do this or something. They just blamed the insurer. They just said, oh, yep, stupid insurer. They won't pay the claim, doggone it. By the way, we created the policy. We could change it. But no, they blamed the insurer. And so I'll also say media are complicit in this, in that the media outlets will just say, hey, big insurer, easy target. That's who we're blaming. And no one really realizes in the end it's the employer who could decide this. In this case, I think Cigna had just said, and it was a brilliant move, Cigna said, you know what? We can't enforce this policy, but we're going to, out of our own bank account separate from this employer, we're going to pay to have this done, which was a smart PR move because it was turning into a mess. But that is the dynamic that I think a lot of people don't understand, is your insurer only enforces the policies that are handed to them by your employer, and your insurer doesn't care. Your insurer would just as happily pay claims as deny them. It's your employer that doesn't want them paid because it comes from their pocketbook.
That is the point I wanted to get across, so people understood that. Now, Home Depot, one of the biggest employers in the country, Walmart, like they have their own bank accounts. They have things like stop loss plans, so that if they're if their actual projections are wrong and it crosses a threshold, they pay an insurance policy to another insurance company to have a stop loss plan, so that anything above a certain threshold gets paid. I wanted people to understand that, because that is how the majority of commercial plans work today. They also, what they sell is they go and build provider networks. So they go out and contract with providers in whatever regions they're selling, and they try to negotiate the lowest possible rates for services. And there's, I don't want to, like, you can do 10 episodes on provider contracting and the models that are there, value-based care and fee-for-service models, which, like, the amount of fee-for-service models that still exist is insane. I've come across some states, like, are fully fee-for-service, like, and they're not controlled. It's just, it's so much waste, and, like, there's no incentive models to do a better job. So quality outcomes has been a trend in the industry where you pay for outcomes, quality and whatnot, and you make more money if you do a better job to try to create the right incentive models. But anyways, employers can recontract. They negotiate. Another one is pharmacy benefits, and there's a lot of, I want to say sketchy, but there's negotiations that happen all along the way in order to negotiate certain pharmacy prices and incentivize providers or insurers to cover certain drugs. You know, there's been some recent laws that have stopped this, but there's pharmacy rebate programs, which I find them questionable. I mean, like, why should an insurer get a kickback for driving, you know, certain amount of prescriptions towards a certain drug?
Those rebates, though, drive a significant portion of the economics of drugs right now in the country. I mean,
unbelievable.
The rebate programs are billions and billions of dollars.
They are billions and billions. And then it gets interesting in payers, right? And I got to be careful because I've worked on some of these, but, like, when you're dealing with, so what's interesting, what Braden just mentioned, right, is that you initiate a contract with an employer, they pay you certain costs and everything else. If you do things on the back end that essentially significantly reduce your expense footprint, there's a debate as to whether or not you have to share those benefits with your employer groups, right? And there's a whole thing there.
Well, now, at least in some aspects, it's, you're required to, in that, thanks to there was a provision in Obamacare back in 2008, but there was a provision that required a medical loss ratio. So there's this term called medical loss ratio, which essentially requires, if you simplify it, it requires any healthcare insurance company that doesn't spend at least 80% or 85%, depending on your size and some other things. If you're not spending 80 or 85% of the premium revenue that you take in from your patients on expenses to the provider's care, then you have to rebate it back to clients. So, to your point, And this is one of those, you know, you talk about unintended consequences of certain laws. If you think about it now from the perspective of an insurer, insurers previously had incredible incentives to try to reduce administrative costs and burdens always, because if they could, they could potentially be more profitable. They could add to their bottom line and to their profits by being more efficient in the way that they administered care. By requiring them to rebate anything that they save back to clients, they're like, ha ha, we're sticking it to the big insurance companies. You know, the two problems with that are, number one, the insurance companies typically on a margin are operating between 2 and 3%. I've never seen a large insurance company that's operating at anything higher than a margin of 3%. So it's not like they're making some disgusting huge margin on this stuff to begin with. But number two, you've now taken away any incentive that they have at all to try to be more profitable or try to cut administrative expense to be more profitable, because you've essentially said, if you're able to do that and to be really efficient, it all goes back to the client. So now essentially they're like, oh, okay. So now we don't really care. We have no skin in the game to try to be more efficient. Mind-boggling that they would put a provision that stupid into, again, I think with the idea of we're sticking it to those big insurance companies, but terrible, terrible idea in terms of controlling incentives.
Long-term, mid-term, long-term. In the short-term, it did for some of that. But
in the short term, what it did,
yes,
is it actually priced smaller and mid-range companies out of insurance. It actually created more of a monopoly situation where smaller organizations that didn't have large administrative staff across, or sorry, large numbers of patients, customers, that they could spread those administrative costs across, got priced out because they couldn't, that their margin was way more than 15 or 20%. It was 30%, but they had really good relationships with their providers and could get really good rates. They got priced out of the market and went out of business. Tons and tons of them. There was a consolidation, huge consolidation.
It's really interesting with this, and I think the last thing I want to talk about, because Breeden and I work a lot in IT and operational side, and how to continually improve that. And I think one of my observations, again, 20 years into this, is that I've come to conclusions, but I don't know what your opinion is, Breeden, but let me think of where we are. We're in 2024. I would say the technology footprint as it relates to the modernization of the technology, I would say we're about in 2007, 2008. Like, we're trailing a good decade plus behind in regard to leveraging technology. Now, on the fringes, there's some stuff that's used, like there's some healthcare insurers that use AI, but they're still running a COBOL mainframe, and batch file to transmit data.
I'll say the large insurance companies. I don't have tons of experience with smallers, but the couple that I've worked with, it seems smaller organizations can be
potentially more
modernized, still, and more nimble.
I've worked with some of them, but a lot of them out of the gates, they're, let's just talk about data sharing.
I don't have a lot
sharing.
Of experience.
I don't want to get into the whole tech thing, but in the modern world, you do not copy data between all those systems because it creates an inherent set of issues with efficiencies, accuracies, everything. But that's what most of them still do. And the tech to get away from that has been a service-based technology model and whatnot. So the last thing I'll say is there's been some data I've had with my friends on this topic. It's like, what? Why?
Jim, just real quick, Jim speaks from painful experience. You were involved. Weren't you involved in some of the claim? Because I think at some point, one of the insurance
modernization
companies that you
at Cigna.
One of the organizations you were working for, I think they had something like 6 or 7 copies internally that we maintained of a given claim.
And it
incidentally, I think there was never an original copy of the core EDI transaction that came in that was stored in its original format ever.
Right. And
I think
so
eventually we got
it.
There.
We fixed it eventually. I think Breeden took over when I had left. It was a continual thing. It's amazing. And it's an interesting model to kind of go through that, because that was an extended and people don't realize the complexity of the transaction on top of the volume. And we were talking 400,000 claims, which are basically invoices for services per day. And
these aren't simple invoices for services, by the way. They're extremely complex.
Very complex. There's some simple ones like I went to my doctor, like PCP visit, but there are other ones like So
you had a surgery, yeah.
And you have a problem and you start queuing that up, these things 400,000, 800,000, 1.2 million, and the average dollar value on each of those is huge. Like, it's insane. So the last thing I'll say is, like, so why doesn't, And it's partially due to what Breeden just said about kind of that MLR introduction. You know, even before that, technology did not get updated. So one is the complexity of the industry, and what I said is, like, you're solving this problem thousands of times at each area and whatnot. Sure, that's a problem. My other premise is that insurance companies can raise. There's the competition isn't pure enough, so insurance companies can raise their premium rates annually at a pace that outpaces, my other favorite topic, inflation, like on the regular. So if there's no incentive to drive efficiencies and costs out, and you could raise your premiums, like, we pay in the US, like, it's 3x any other developed country for healthcare, like per capita. Like, Bernie had it in his commencement speech. And our outcomes aren't worth that. It's 3x. And our outcomes are crap.
We could again agree to disagree. How much of that cost is exposed? Agreed. Data is data, and I think what you're not seeing is what is the tax burden associated with healthcare systems in some of these places where you're not getting direct premiums, but your taxes are paying for a significant portion more.
I think it's covered in there, but that's maybe something to look up. But the thing that drives me crazy is the tech, like why doesn't technology get updated? And what are the drivers behind that? I think,
sure.
You know, some of it is the ability to, like, if you're not forced to drive efficiency out, like, I mean, Braden and I talked about an executive we both had dealt with and is like, you know, did the comparison between the healthcare, you know, transactions to like an ATM transaction. And it's just like, dude, but, you know, I think to the point, similar to the consulting episode, what I want to just, there's a couple of points I don't think a lot of people understand. And again, like we didn't even scratch the surface of how things actually work, how those entities interact, you know, the different models we have. You have concept, Braden mentioned consultants, there's brokers who sell, who have different incentive models than like the employers, and, you know, how do the pharmacy companies interact? There's a gazillion things. And then there's the operating environment within these organizations too. You know, I think it's important for people to understand that, but I look, insurers aren't like, you know, angels. Like their whole thing is they're profit driven entities. So their incentives aren't to improve care. Their incentives to improve care aren't, in my opinion, necessarily pure. I think people do want to improve care overall, but within the context of achieving
their
financial goals. So.
Totally with you. But Jim, for that very reason, one of the reasons that I differ with you in single payer versus a privately administrated system is that there are incentives. Granted, it's monetary incentives, but there are incentives for insurers to improve the cost efficiency, well, without MLR, cost efficiency and outcomes of care, right? When you go to a single payer system, you take every incentive away.
No, it's forced. No, it's not an incentive. It's a forced rule. Like right. You can still do it, but it's different. It's not an incentive model. It's a rule. It's a law. It's a
and this is regulation. What I'm saying. So let me. My experience when you get regulation-driven versus incentive-driven, if I have incentive-driven, right, I have, we can say, like, have you ever gotten your license at the AAA versus the DMV?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever had this.
There you experience. Go. That's a good comparison. It's regular.
I went to the AAA. The AAA is a private company. And I went there and I said, okay, here, I'm number one or whatever. Like, oh, yeah, there's no line here. Come here. And they knew if I don't like their service, AAA will go out of business, right? They're not a government entity. It's a private company. They'll go out of business. Maybe not because of that, but the point is they don't survive if they don't provide excellent, quick responsiveness to customer needs. The DMV doesn't give a flying rip whether or not I get what I need or not. They don't care. They're not going to stop existing tomorrow. If I get really angry, maybe I could call my congressman and there would be a very diffuse committee meeting that would have even more diffuse notes that would have even a more diffuse, you know, impact. Like there's no accountability. If you get into a single payer system or more generally when the government owns a business, right, a function, the accountability gets so diffused that there's never responsiveness. And you can think of any number of entities that the government runs where you say the responsiveness and the incentives to innovate, to be efficient, et cetera, are gone. Yes, there's a law that says you can only spend this much. You can only do this much. Great. They'll adhere to that. And what you'll get is people leaving the medical industry. You'll get innovation stopping. You'll get so many things that stop happening because the money's not there anymore.
Well,
that's my
thing. You know, I understand what you're saying generally. The problem is the private industry has tried to do this, hasn't been able to do it. And then, by the way, all the new the new innovations coming out of CMS for especially Medicare, right, and Medicaid as well, is to build quality-based and incentive-driven contracts, star ratings, you know, that go back to consumer satisfaction outcomes, things like that. And they're evolving that. So this is a much bigger discussion, but I mean, I think in order for people to participate, my thing is, if you're going to participate, just like anything else, I would say, if you're going to participate in a dialogue on the topic, just like anything else, get informed, right? Like, again, this is a really tough one, right? So I think people do just be like, you know, do look at it like government run, everything is a waste. Well, work in the private industry and see how much waste there is too. Like, you know, and so, you know, how do you, and I think the problem Braden and I always, you know, when we had time to actually think about this, how do you drive those efficiencies? So anyways, that was what we wanted to cover. I don't know if you guys enjoy that. I think some people would find this interesting, especially if you don't live and work in this world. But give us your thoughts. We covered pre-crime, censorship, religion, politics, and healthcare. I mean, I don't know what didn't touch.
What more? I mean, you pretty much can just close the podcast as all-encompassing at that point.
I took a course that said if you cover controversial topics, you're going to get a bigger audience. You know? So there we go. Lots of clips coming out of this one. Thank you guys for joining us on this one. This is another really short episode. We'll try to make it a little longer and more engaging next time. So please give us a like, share, subscribe. Let us know if there's other topics you want. You know, any of those things really help us out. I'd like to get this podcast self-funded at some point, because it's they're not kind of self-funded. It's us funded. I'd like it to be entity itself funded. But we'll get there at some point. But thank you guys. And Braden, anything else before we?
No, I think I'm good. We've caused enough problems as it is.
All right. Well, thanks everybody. And we'll catch you next time.
See ya. Okay.